Welcome to the DisList podcast. The DisList podcast is part of the journal Disability in Libraries and Information Studies. I am the host, Jess Schomburg. Today, I'll be collecting an oral history from disabled librarian Katie Manweller to hear her stories about working in libraries with disability. Do you want to do a brief introduction of yourself? Anything you want to share?
Oh, sure. I'm an academic librarian in Pennsylvania. I'm primarily an instruction librarian for education departments. And most of my scholarship and service focuses on disability inclusion in libraries and higher education. I'm dynamically disabled myself. I have a number of chronic illnesses, with my primary diagnosis being Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And so I've been working on researching and advocating for disability inclusion in libraries for about 5 years now.
Awesome. And are there any other identities that impact your work experience that you would be open to talking about or want to talk about today?
I don't think necessarily. I mean, I'm a cisgender white woman in librarianship, so I'm like the main kind. but besides the major thing that really impacts my experience is my experience with disability. And I think also, in particular, how open I am about being disabled and kind of how straightforward I am with that. I think it's definitely a different experience than folks who aren't as comfortable doing that or aren't safe enough to do that. So I think there's pros and cons to kind of those different approaches.
Well, since you brought it up, do you want to talk a little bit about what you see as the pros and cons of being so open?
Yeah. I mean, so the pro is for me, well, part of it is because I just can't not. I don't know. Like, disability is so central to what I'm doing that I can't not be. And I'm just a very straightforward person that I'm going to talk about it. And it's also like not become my whole personality, but it's a very strong like interest of mine. So I've talked about it a lot, right? Part of it is because my scholarship is centered around disability. I'm in a tenure track position. So I have to explain my scholarship, not just when I was applying to get this job, but also when I go up for tenure. So when I interviewed for this position, I talked about my identity connected to the larger presentation I was doing and to kind of explain my scholarship. So that was a pro because it's central to what I'm the work I'm doing, right? If it's not, then if it's like not central to the work you're doing in librarianship, which it certainly doesn't have to be, then there, I think, is a lot more potential cons to being open about your disability in the workplace, because there is such one, like, not good understanding about what disability means. I've had been in previous workplaces where people work say things to me like, you're too young to be so tired. I never would have thought you had chronic fatigue. A lot of misconception about what disability looks like, right? So there's that starter barrier. And if your disability is not visibly apparent to others, there's the potential for a lot of judgment because people think disability is something they can see. So when you're trying to talk about disability that's not apparent, non-disabled people, or even people who don't identify as disabled, have a really hard time, even people who are disabled, have a hard time understanding those complexities. But again, sorry, I'm not going in a linear fashion with this. To get workplace accommodations, you have to disclose in some manner. So you are under no obligation to disclose. So if you can self-accommodate, bring in a HEPA filter for your office for yourself, or a lamp for your office to light, if there's ways that you can adjust your workplace to better suit your access needs without having to disclose, by all means, do that. It is, in the long run, probably the safest option for you. But you do need to disclose a disability to some extent, at least with your human resources or your supervisor, to be able to get an accommodation. So you have to, a lot of people don't have a choice in whether or not they can be open, not just because if the disability might be obvious, and so then they really don't have a choice, but our systems are structured in a way that often to be able to meet your needs, you have to disclose maybe more than you want to.
So I'm going to circle back a little bit what you said when you were talking about how if disability is central to your work, it can be beneficial to disclose. And that reminded me of, I cannot remember the name of it. It's been a few years since I looked at it, but there's document, white paper, policy statement, something like that, that came out of the UK that observed that institutions will selectively benefit from disabled people. Like, if you could be a good spokesperson, they will put you on the front of a marketing thing with your wheelchair. And that's more often white men who are marketed in that fashion. And it just sort of made me wonder, like, is that a thing that you've thought about before? Or do you have thoughts about it now, about like disclosing for institutional benefit might be more acceptable? But like, I don't know, I have weird feelings about it. So I'm curious about your feelings.
I mean, there's definitely the risk of being like the token disabled person, right? And when I was thinking about benefits, I was thinking about it more in being able to connect to your work. So in terms of like the disability rights movement saying nothing about us without us, being able to say that I'm doing work on disability inclusion because I'm disabled and this is my experience in libraries, I think there's a lot of benefit for the same thing with like research on the experience of like BIPOC folks in library being from actual BIPOC folks, right? It's that, for lack of a better term, own voices experience. That's what I see as the kind of the benefit of disclosing if you're including disability or accessibility central to your work. However, it's also can't be a requirement because people might be not safe enough to publicly disclose. But in a broader sense, I have never really thought about it in terms of like being like the token disabled person at like from my own experience. One, because most people would not assume I'm disabled, but also because I feel like I just cause more like issues than at my institution that then they would want to highlight.
You are saying that you are the squeaky wheel. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think in some manners, obviously I'm just like a small, like I'm not the, but like, yeah.
It's very relatable. Yes. So you currently work at an academic. Is that, like, are you okay going into your library work history? Is that the only type of library you've worked in? Or like what has your job path been with libraries?
I've primarily like professionally worked in academic libraries. I did work like after graduate school before I got a full-time job, worked part-time in a public library. And like I worked my closest job experience, I think, to public library in some extent is I have a pretty long customer like retail experience too. But so I've always worked professionally in academic libraries. This is the third library I've worked in since I graduated from graduate school. But my first position was as an archivist. And then I moved into an instruction role and now the role I'm in now. But it has all been in academic, which, and like moving through those roles, my experience with disability changed a lot. When I started my role as as the archivist, my health was probably as stable as it's ever been when I was an adult. And then in the midst of moving from my first job to my second job, I got a pretty bad case of the shingles, which caused my health to decline for about 2 years. So in my second job is when I really was coming to terms with the being disabled and my health becoming much more disabling, or my chronic illnesses becoming much more disabling. And that's the role where I really started to focus on disability. But because of all of that, I've always been in institutions where issues would go through an institutional human resources for the whole university. So it's a lot different of an experience than a public library, who it would have a lot like less employees, a lot less, fewer access to those like institutional resources. So it's definitely different than other types of like library jobs or managing disability in the workplace.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one can say many things about HR, but having people who are supposed to be trained in ADA at least is real different than having only a supervisor to work with who may or may not know or care about any of it, for sure.
Well, and the ADA only applies if you have 15 or more employees. So I'm sure there are public libraries that have less than 15 employees. And in addition, like at a campus, you're more likely to have an ADA coordinator, which is not a required position, but it is a position. So like my ADA coordinator is in our Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. And it's like the top, like she's also the main like Title IX investigator too. Sorry if you hear my dog snoring. And so she's like separate from HR, and that would vary on institution. An ADA coordinator is not required, but it is like a certification they have to get in training. So again, that's like an additional resource that I have access to in a higher ed institution that you won't in like even smaller higher ed institutions or public libraries.
So even though public libraries are government agencies, I know that becomes weird with state laws. Oh, so this will also depend on state.
Mm-hmm. Some, like a very few public libraries in Pennsylvania are attached to local public government, and they often have like a section of their funding that's from the local public government, but they're by and large independent organizations in Pennsylvania. That's why like the public library system in Pittsburgh is the Carnegie public library system.
Oh.
Example, or like the free library. That's like all I know about is in Pennsylvania, but it makes it like things like funding and stuff even more challenging. But yes, they're not government agencies.
Oh, I think mm-hmm. I'm so used to Minnesota where everything is, I mean.
Well, I think that's the most typical, I don't want to say application of, I don't know, of, or like setup for public libraries is that they are like a municipal service and like, often they are connected in some way to your, in Pennsylvania, to your local governments. But yeah, it's all largely independent, like nonprofit organizations. So for example, if they're not part, again, if it's just an independent public library that's not part of the like county government, they're less likely to have enough employees to meet that 15 employee minimum or have access to like a professional HR department.
Yeah, so then they're much more equivalent to like a typical nonprofit than. Okay, cool. Yeah. I did not know that. Yeah, I'm sure every state's different, and outside the U.S. too. I really don't know how.
I don't know either.
Yeah. Okay. Well, cool. That is like now I'm aware of this blank spot in my brain about how libraries work. That's going to send me down a rabbit hole sometime. but so kind of related to that. So because of your background working for institutions like that, does that mean that like how did that impact your job search and hiring processes with? Was it all pretty consistent across agency that you worked for? Or was that also really varied?
What do you mean?
Like in terms of when you're looking for jobs, the hiring processes, possibly. Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's okay. So when I was looking for to move from when I first got out of grad school, I was just looking for a job. And then when I was looking to leave my first job, it was because that job was in Erie. And so we were like 6 hours away from our family. The only way to get across the state of Pennsylvania is to drive it. So we were just really far away. And I knew I wanted to move into a more instruction focused role. And so, and I was just applying again to mostly location jobs that were in like the general vicinity of where our family was. And I don't know, I interviewed for like 3 or 4 jobs before I got the one that I ended up getting. And that again, it was more location and the job description because the job I ended up getting was an evening job because that's what I could get in the type. And so there was a lot of issues with that and long-term and general accessibility. But when I was applying for this job that I have, I didn't actually apply for this job. So I I really wanted to be in a tenure track role because I had started doing scholarship, even though it wasn't required at my last position. I had started doing research about the experience of like librarians with non-apparent disabilities and academic librarianship. And so I knew that was really central. And our state system has a lot of really great benefits because our librarians in my state higher ed system are faculty just like any other faculty. So we are in our collective bargaining agreement. We have a union, a pretty like stable union, and we have all the same benefits as teaching or classroom faculty. So like a 9-month schedule, and the pay is better than like anywhere else in Pennsylvania. So there's a lot of more material benefits. So the job I applied to at my current position was a collections job that I could have done, but I didn't want to do that job. I wanted to be in a tenure track role, and I was like, I'll make it work. And what ended up happening is my colleague got the tenure that role, but at the same time that we were going through that process, the education librarian decided not to return, because this was during the, like, I interviewed in 2020-2021. So like the following academic year was when my university was returning to on in-person teaching or in-person learning during the first few years of the pandemic, and the education librarian decided to retire and not come back. So they were able to just kind of offer me that job, which lucked out because I liked this job so much. It's a really good fit for me, but it was more about those kind of the benefits of tenure track and the recognition of my scholarship that made me want to get this job. And interestingly, because I was interviewing during 2021, all of my interviews were on Zoom. So like my full day interview was on Zoom too, but by the nature of it, over the time. And it's interesting because even we talk about how difficult the academic hiring process is, and even though it was all on Zoom, I was so tired after it that I slept for like 12 hours and then tried to work like a half day and ended up having to take sick time to sleep the rest of the day because I was so exhausted from the interview.
Yeah. Also very relatable. The academic hiring process is brutal. Just yes.
Yeah.
But it worked out. You got the job.
Yeah. I mean, it worked out better than I expected. So.
So now that you are in this position, what kind of like institutional support structures or personal support structures do you have access to? In addition to the AD coordinator on your campus.
Yeah. So I am a member of a union. And so that's been really helpful in terms of the two times I've gone through accommodations, the accommodation process at my institution. Each time I went through meetings with the like higher up HR person, my union president was there in the meeting to take notes. And even though my HR is like pretty terrible with accommodations, they do allow an HR representative to be present, even though they don't legally have to. So that like is a good thing. So my union president came to the meetings and would like kind of interface with the HR VP to try to help get to a solution, and was there to support if I wasn't able, if they like denied anything, to go through like the grievance process. And I've also like had, this is the first place that I've worked that I've really made friends at the institution, which has been really nice. And like, so for example, I'm friends with our director of student, like the disability services offices, who has also gone through accommodations at Westchester for himself. And so the two of us are like unofficially like watchdogs of our HR, because like we will notice things on their website and we'll take it to our diversity office and we'll be like, this is bad. And we are both in the process of being trained to be member reps for our union, but that are going to be dedicated to the accommodations process, because faculty are getting denied accommodations a lot. And our union president has said that the only reason that the two of us have been able to get accommodations is because we know the law and know how to push back against HR in ways that most people don't. We are curious to see if HR is going to rescind the ability for a union rep or restrict it in some way when we show up to meetings. We're not sure how that's going to go, but our HR couldn't even provide our union with data. They asked for like how many people have requested accommodations and how many of those have been confirmed, like approved or denied. They didn't have that information. And So the union has been a big support, even though there's not a ton like they can practically do. It's just having like the kind of backup, I think, is useful. But unfortunately, like most, like a lot, like most academic librarians don't have access to a union. So it's really difficult to do that.
Yeah, we actually have, because I'm also in a unionized, I think our work contracts must be really similar. But one thing that our union was able to negotiate in our current contract is the right of employees to bring a union rep with them to those meetings. Like it's now been like deliberately negotiated in our contract because I'm on part of a system and some seem like some of the campus HRs were fine-ish with it and some were like absolutely not. So, but yeah, having a union is helpful, but also having to go through your union to have your legal rights upheld it's a thing.
Well, yeah. And there's also limitations too. So, and accommodations are not great across my system. And so there was someone at a sister school who like had a heart transplant and they wanted him to teach in person in like fall 2020. And he was like, no. and they said, well, then you can't, they wouldn't approve his accommodations request. And so the union could grieve it, but like they can't do anything in immediate. So he ended up suing for violation of his section 504 and ADA rights. And the federal judge did agree that because they were saying it violated his, like it substantially changed his job description. And the federal judge said like the primary responsibility is teaching and not teaching in person. So as long as he's teaching virtually, he's still fulfilling his primary, but he had to go through a lawsuit because the union can't do that. Like they can't like represent him in court in the same way. So there are limitations there as well that you would still, even if you didn't have a union, you would still likely have to do something when things are such an immediate threat to your health.
Yeah. And yeah, that's like a union can grieve a contract, but it can't file a lawsuit on your behalf related to your civil rights. Yeah.
And I'm hoping to continue to do more with our union. My union president asked me to become our, it's basically our sick leave bank chair, because I've also had issues with HR accessing our sick leave bank. And then I'm now a member of my campus executive committee. And so I'm hoping throughout the years we can work to try to coordinate more like disability support throughout the union statewide. But I mean, early days, but my friend and I were tossing around ideas. And we were talking for a while about trying to do like an employee resource group for disability on our campus. And then with talking with our union, we were like, the immediate need is just being able to get people accommodations. So like, that's where we need to go. And our plan is we have to like finish going through the training, but our plan is to be able to like meet with someone before they meet with HR to like prepare them, be present so that we can like recognize when HR is saying ridiculous things, and then like kind of debrief them afterwards to help them through next steps is what we're thinking, because that's kind of the most immediate need, because people are getting denials and don't know what to do.
Seems like a universal problem. Yeah. But so how did you, because you know a lot about ADA, like you were one of the people that I go to first if I ever have a question. So how did you, like, what started you on the journey, or how did you end up here where like you just know a lot and you're like able to point out where things are like, this is wonky with ADA, or ADA doesn't cover this, or just, I know you provide a lot of guidance and support for people with these sorts of questions.
It's really just been through going through the accommodations experience a lot. So I like never considered disability accommodations, because it's not something, right, that you're ever like told about. Really, most people aren't like in onboarding or anything like that. So I started learning about accommodations when I started doing research on non-apparent disability in the workplace. So it's when I first started learning about how accommodations work and all the problems accessing accommodations for people with like chronic illnesses in the workplace. And then I had a therapist at my last job. The therapist wasn't at my last job. While I was at my last job, my therapist had recommended asking for an accommodation, and specifically for like an office chair that had a high, like a head specs, a head and neck support. And I had never thought about that before. And so I had contacted my HR to like go through the process. And I thought it was going to be more formal than it was. And it was just like me talking to her basically, which is really what the interactive process is. And I just didn't really know that at the time. And so then I also was hoping to do partial work from home because my fatigue was really bad at that time. But that was like January 2020. The plan was to like get this new office chair stream that helped my fatigue at work. And then I worked entirely from home for over a year. So like it, but then things like when I got into my current position, I applied for an accommodation or requested an accommodation before I even started because I knew I was going to need partial work from home because of how beneficial that was to managing my symptoms. And it like I right off the bat, I like requested accommodations in July and they didn't get approved until October. But through that process, there were so many questionable things HR said and did that I had to look stuff up to share. So like one example is they were really hesitant to want to allow me to do any sort of work from home. And how it worked out is because we had returned to campus, you couldn't teach online unless the class had been approved for online learning. But 50% of my job duties are scholarship and service because I'm tenure track. So I ended up getting that 50% of my job duties approved from work from home, basically. So I can work from home for 2 to 3 days a week. It's supposed to be just scholarship and service is what I do on those days. But like, for example, like this week, I have a lot more scholarship stuff. So I'm working from home 3 days this week because I do have a lot of scholarship. And so I'm taking advantage of that. But there was just a lot of questionable things that HR did that process was so demoralizing that I was like applying for new jobs like a month into my current job. And the top HR guy is just like not nice in meetings. And so like the big thing that like really got me turned is like I was aware of things like the job accommodation network but I hadn't like used it extensively. And so in our meetings, I was trying to request, we were talking about why I needed to work from home and I was talking about chronic pain and fatigue. And one of the things they're saying is that my commute adds a lot of like worsens those symptoms for a number of reasons. And the HR guy said that the only thing they consider is my on-campus workday in this process. And so I thought that was an ADA rule that I wasn't aware of. So after that meeting, I like looked up telework on JAN, the Job Accommodation Network, to see what their documentation said. And like the first barrier listed as something that can be resolved with telework is commute. And so I sent that documentation to HR then, being like, maybe he's not aware. And the next meeting, he was like, oh no, I knew about that. And then just never talked about it again. And my union president is pretty sure that that's the reason I got it approved, because I had a very clear documentation that supported it. And if they denied it, it was like an obvious grievance, right? That they're saying that I can't do this because commute isn't supported by the ADA and the federal documentation is saying it is. So she thinks that's the only reason that I really got that approved. And so that really like kind of kickstarted it. And so after going through that process, I started giving presentations on disability accommodations for library workers. So I presented twice to my like, state library institution and then a few times to like individual library systems. And so that necessitated more research because I wanted people to be able to have the knowledge necessary to do it successfully. And then so the second time I went through the process was in the fall of 2022. And it was because my campus had stopped pouring masks. And so I was requesting HEPA filters in the two spots in the library where I had to be with bubble, like the reference desk and the children's literature room. And again, I had to use documentation to kind of back up my claims because they immediately denied it without going through the interactive process. And even then I like reached out to my friend in the disability services office. And he's like, no, they're denying your interactive process. They have to meet me to talk about this. Here's some links about this. And then I looked up more links and I like found the documentation from the EEOC that said HEPA filters are reasonable accommodation for being high risk for COVID and sent that to them. And in the end, they basically told me, that the university's, and the weird thing was too, I'm a graduate student at my institution as well. And I was requesting the exact same accommodation as a student. And they did it immediately without any question. They're just like, there'll be a HEPA filter, extra HEPA filters in your room within a week. And they were there. And so that was like especially frustrating because of how HR was dragging it out, because it's the same process. And so my union president, again, this was one of the ways it was really key to have her, because she was like talking to him on the phone being like, if the university is doing this for her as a student, why can't they do it for her as an employee? And he's like, oh, that's a completely different thing. And it's like, it's not, it's the same law, same law. Generally, it's like, it's the same process, even if they're handled very differently, right? At universities. And what ended up happening is they basically, the HR person told my union president that the lawyers would not approve any accommodations related to COVID. So they gave me HEPA filters as a courtesy and closed my accommodations request without a decision. And I did agree to that. And I talked her through with my union president. She said that they could deny you and you could grieve it, but we don't know how long that'll take to then eventually get the HEPA filters. So I did agree to that. But like the head of HR was like, yeah, we can send her a HEPA filter for her office. And we were like, that's not what she's asking for. I had already had a HEPA filter in my office that I purchased myself. She's like, did you even like read the requests? Like, that's not what she's asking for. And whatever. But those experiences, and the second time I went through it, I was much less demoralized and much just more angry, because I was better informed and like more of a stance of pissed off about it. But without all that knowledge, it's so easy to just feel like you have to give up because HR's, and like even the denial letter was really snotty. It was like, we have made a set a huge effort to include HEPA filters all around campus. This does not qualify for an accommodation. And I was like, the reason I'm asking is because there's not HEPA filters in the places that I need them to be. And also, this does qualify according to the EEOC. So shut up. And so that's kind of where it's gotten today. And then like I have a book chapter that's coming out sometime in the next year or so that is really breaking it down in detail. So I like read into the law even in like more detail. And it's largely just because I had such a difficult time with the process that I know. And like I have a friend who at my institution who like tried to request partial work from home for being high risk for COVID as well, for RA. And they just said an immediate denial. And she was like, okay, well, I guess that's it. And like, most people don't know that that's not supposed to be it. Like they have to find you some sort of accommodation. And so like, it's really become more of like a, because of that experience and having to learn so much about it to be able to do it successfully. And knowing that most people don't have that knowledge, trying to talk about it in more depth so that other people can do it successfully. It was a long-winded answer. I'm sorry.
No, that's a good answer. And it's kind of like the next question I had prepared was, how did you get involved in advocating for people with disability? And I think the answer was anger, I believe. Sorry, yeah. You're drinking water.
I mean, yes. Also, it's not just that, but the other big reason is actually Twitter, because when I was going through the experience of my health declining severely, especially in 2018, coming to terms with being disabled, I was also like, my therapist at the time was someone who specialized in therapy for people with chronic illnesses. So that was really helpful in like coming to terms, going through that grief stage and everything like that. But at the same time that it was happening, I ended up finding like a really great community of other library workers with disabilities on Twitter. And that kind of community is another main reason that I kind of turned to advocacy and like building more of a community, because that community was really vital for me in going through that like acceptance period and coming to terms with it and like finding purpose and pride in it. And I mean, it just kind of so happened. And there was like also other people that I followed who were like disability advocates more generally, but it was more so because of being active in library Twitter and finding a lot of people who were going through similar things professionally and building kind of that sort of community. Makes me really miss Twitter because it's garbage now and there's not a good replication of it. But that, I think that community is also the other big reason, being supportive in community, I think makes a big difference for people with disabilities. Having that sort of access intimacy in and of itself can be really great to find a place within your profession that you can have that when it's overall, most people don't understand non-obvious access needs. Yeah.
Yeah, and that kind of brings us to the next question I had prepared, which is, why do people with disabilities need advocates? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the main thing is that there's just such poor cultural understanding of disability. I talk about this. I do a presentation sometimes called Disability is Not a Bad Word. And I talk about kind of the historical development of our understanding of what normal is, because, like, I don't know, like 200-300 years ago, like pre-industrial revolution, disability wasn't society the way it is now, right? It was just like a fact of life, kind of. There was no like ideal body. There was just you, and obviously like a lot less health supports, but you would like just care in community as much as you could, depending on the circumstances. But with the Industrial Revolution, there became, and so like, so the field of statistics was developing at the same time as eugenics, and they were the same people. And so they were looking for like an ideal person, an ideal worker, I should say, with the Industrial Revolution, the idea of an average man. And that's how like the normalcy of bodies became really prevalent in our culture under capitalism, that there is a normal body and then other an abnormal. And I mean, it doesn't, like, obviously the long history of the United States of ugly laws, people with disabilities not being able to like really be in public, the separations, the long history of institutionalization, no access to education. It's only really been in the last 50 years that people with disabilities have been able to be integrated most to some extent, if not fully, into our society. So that's part of it. And there's just also just not, people think disability is a bad thing because of the way we've talked about disability culturally, like things like special needs, that oh, they're special, that they need help, a lot of infantilization of people with disabilities, that, and because our culture is really driven by capitalism, driven by being able to work, we see disability only as being not able to work. So people, everything's like viewed through that like work binary or that work frame. So people think disability is just not being able to work, when that's not true at all. And we just don't have good cultural understanding or representation of what disability is, because we don't like to talk about it. The reality is it's very limited to things like being a wheelchair user. And even that's not well understood, because people don't understand. People just think if you use a wheelchair, you are paralyzed, and that's not true either. But like things that are visible, again, like I mentioned earlier, people think you have to, like, you can see what disability is. And so I think that's one of the main reasons we need disability advocates, is just to talk about what disability actually is, because people have such, just have limited, and that's not necessarily anyone's fault. It's just the way our culture has presented disability. But because of that, we don't have really expansive inclusion, because the inclusion is really limited to those, that limited idea of, stereotypical idea of disability. And lots of people who have disabilities don't really understand that that's what's happening, and are able to seek out enough support for that.
Yep. I'm just nodding. Yeah. So if you were to do like a public service announcement about disability, like what would you have in it? What would you say the public needs to know?
I do really like the presentation and the phrasing that I use, that disability is not a bad word, that just to kind of attempt to destigmatize, right? That, and to assure people that they can talk about disability. It's an okay thing. Like, it is a fact of life. 25% of American adults have a disability. Like, it's a normal part of, I think that's part of the thing too, is we think it's like an outlier, when it's a normal part of human existence. There will always be people, there always has been, there always will be people with disabilities. It is just a normal part of life, and it is an okay thing to talk about. And then also, it's really important to use the word disability, because it's the language that protects us under the civil rights laws, right? So under the Individuals with Disability and Education Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act, disability is a legal term. And so that it's really important to actually use the word disability when we're talking about disability, and not use like fluffy euphemisms, because then you're not like recognizing the protected group that that person is in.
You did a really succinct job of getting to that point. I appreciate that, because I'm always like, I feel like, I don't know how to describe this, but like, yes, That is why it's important to say the word disability. And I always want to like clutter the explanation up with like lots of different points and facts and here's a book to read and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, you just got to say it.
I have presented on it a number of times. So that's part of it. I have practice talking about it. But I do think there's other things too. Like disability communities have like circled around other words, but it always just comes back to disability. And I think there's an assumption that the dis is a negative. And even just like I push back when people try to say like are making equity statements and they say abilities instead of disability. And I'm like, you're not talking about ability, you're talking about disability. Just use the word disability because that's what you're talking about. You don't have to dance around it. Or like varying abilities. Like if you're talking about equity, you're not talking about like varying abilities. You're talking about equity for disabled people. So yeah.
Who is it? Who is the target of systemic discrimination here?
Yeah.
It's the people who are marked as having disability. Yeah.
And so I've talked about this a number of times, which is probably why it was succinct. But there's also like the cultural connection to disability going back through like the disability rights movement that was found through in the 70s, that strong culture, which is part of it too. But I think that the easiest and most straightforward way to get people to use the word is to talk about it as a legal definition in a matter of civil rights, because most people think it's a medical diagnosis and it's not. You're not diagnosed as disabled. You're diagnosed with something that counts as a disability under the law. And so because of the way we have that set up in the United States, we really need to focus on that. And I think that gets people somewhat separated from the like cultural stigma around disability. And hopefully it's a more straightforward recognition of the terminology. And hopefully makes it easier to break down those barriers if this is a bad word.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. Okay. So we're kind of getting close to the end of our time. So I have two more planned questions, but also if there's anything that you want to bring up, please, please feel free. But my second to last planned question is kind of abstract. You can go anywhere you want with it. But what is unique about library workers as people with disability?
And before I answer that, I do want to say, since we started a little bit late, I have time if we need to go into it. Okay. So I think one of the really unique things for library workers with disability is our profession's commitment to access for all and how contrary that is to actual disability inclusion, because our field has this commitment to providing access to everyone and regardless of like who it is to everyone, right? That's like the core tenet of librarianship, at least in America. And we have no concept as a profession of what that means for disabled people. Like we have some things, like we'll like really basic things, right? So like adhering to the ADA, which is like the bare minimum you're supposed to do by law. And even when you are adhering to the ADA, you're not actually like really fully accessible, right? And like just those sorts of bare minimum things is how we really think about disability. And I mean, like there's more stuff in recent years, especially around like sensory story times, those sorts of things are sort of like isolated things. But even then, our ideas of access for all don't extend to our profession, like our workers, right? Even though we have had conversations for a long time about how white our profession is and things like that, and the need to improve those things, that stuff isn't, like it's only, disability is only mentioned in like a lip service way, right? So like ACRL's website on EDI mentions disability in terms of like encouraging an increase of people with various identities with disability, but there's not anything more than that, right? And so we have this field dedicated to access, but we don't actually, one, understand what access to disability looks like, and especially don't do much at all around access for library workers with disabilities. I do think that's at least becoming more of a conversation because there's been a lot more literature about it in the last few years, and some more kind of like professional development things have started happening, but it's just really interesting how that we're in such this like feels like opposite world sometimes, that this is like our core tenet belief as a field and we can't even do it for ourselves type of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of, I don't know, I So there's two factoids. Oh, I recently learned that factoid in the US means like little informational nugget, and factoid outside the US means false fact.
Really?
Yeah, right. And so I just realized as I was saying, I was like, no, I need to not say the word factoid, because that's anybody who's not from the US listening to this is going to be like, what? So there are a couple of like information tidbits that I know that frustrate me related to this topic that I don't know how to move on from. But like one is, and they both kind of stem from the same time frame. So one is that ALA started collecting racial demographic statistics.
And they ask, oh, okay.
And so, yeah, talking about race and the professional statistics, even with all of the, again, lip service that we as a profession provide to DEI topics, like our numbers haven't moved. Like we're just as white as we were in 1990.
And I mean, granted, there hasn't been an actual study since around 2010. There's only just been the self-reporting study through ALA. Not everyone's an ALA member, et cetera, et cetera. But like the percentages of white people have gone down like 2% from like 88 to 86. Of the profession. Yeah. And in terms of disability, that self-reporting form from HRL or ALA asks if you have a disability, yes, no. And it's really, I hate when surveys do that because they're not explaining what disability means. And so you're going to lose a lot of people who do count under our federal legislation who don't personally identify as having disability and have no way of knowing that. And so the most recent data from 2017 from that form is like 2% of the profession has a self-reported disability, and like a three that there's like, and there's no way that's that low when we're a field of mostly women and women are one in four women have a disability. Like that's not accurate. And even if like, obviously, people with disability in the workforce is a lower percentage than that whole 25%, right? But there's more than three.
Yeah, and that's related to the other little information tidbit. Like the ADA was passed in around 1990. There are actually like fewer disabled people in the workforce now than there were then.
Yeah,
because I mean, you talked about your own.
Sorry, there's a trash truck outside.
I cannot hear it. So, but yeah. So you've talked about your own struggles. I know you've done research in this area. Like even in higher ed, even with HR that's trained and supposed to be helpful, it's like the number of times people have to file lawsuits to get their legal deeds met and still lose in court, or the number of...
It is very unlikely to sue for disability and get it upheld. And disability discrimination is the second highest form of discrimination that the EEOC gets claims about after like wrongful termination. And some of this is, I think some of it, the number wise, is because you are more likely, as you age, you tend to get more disabilities. And because of the baby boomer generation now aging out of the workforce, by and large, I think that is part of it, because that's such a big generation that's no longer in the workforce, and they're also more likely to have disabilities. So I think that might be some of the numbers, but it's also, I think there was the 2008 ADA amendments, because like after the ADA was passed, it was just like lawsuit after lawsuit about like, that ended up being like who counts as disabled. And so the ADA amendments has basically of 2008 basically said that like really try to expand that to be broadest term as possible, that it's not just like being able to do about your daily tasks, but also the function of your body. And that makes a difference, but I don't know. I mean, disability discrimination is really common and really difficult to get upheld in court. And we also know that more people becoming disabled as of late because of COVID. I mean, in the higher ed context, there's more like students with disability going to school, but they're still less likely to graduate than their peers. And so I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen as long COVID continues to disable people, what it'll look like. I don't know.
So we're about at the end. We're joined by my cat. You may hear a yowl, and that's just because she's happy. There we go. So my last question for you, because we've talked about some heavy things, and JJ suggested that I include something fun here, because JJ knows how to bring in the fun. So my last question for you is, what book or movie or game are you really excited about right now?
Well, I'm really excited about right now. I just listened to this, so I don't know if this is a good answer, but I was really excited about We Solve Murders, which is the first book in the new series by the author of The Thursday Murder Club, which is my I love that book series so much. It's some of my favorite books that I've ever read. And so he just came out with the first book in a new series that I listened to the audiobook within like 48 hours. And so I don't think it's as good as Thursday Murder Club, but that's what I was like really, really excited about of late.
Thank you all for listening to this podcast. I was delighted to have the opportunity to talk with Katie and learn more about how she advocates for inclusion in library spaces. Show notes with links to more information about some of the ideas we talked about are provided on the DisList Journal website, along with a transcript of this recording.